given the traits that you're discovering, given what you're learning about Ardipithecus, can you infer a lifestyle for this creature? Or what can you infer?
Well, maybe the best way to think about that is what it would have been like 4.4 million years ago had you been able to get in a time machine. Let's say we took our time machine to Aramis today. Before we step into the time machine, we look around and we see a desert. And there, it's a very harsh place. There are pastoralists there, no agriculture is possible, very little water, very little rain, very little vegetation. It's a desert. And these ancient sediments are eroding. So now imagine we step into the time machine, set the dial to 4.4 million years ago and go back in time. And we get out of the time machine and the place has completely changed. We're in the same place, but 4.4 million years ago, this was a really different world. All of a sudden, we're not even on a grassland. We're no longer in a desert. We are in a woodland environment. And we look up in the trees and we see that they're full of monkeys. And we look around on the ground and we see there are a lot of kudus. And we see an occasional hyena. And we see elephants. And we see lots of small mammals. And we know what all these mammals and birds and plants, we know what they are because we found evidence of them. And then we'd look through, and if we're lucky on that particular day in that particular place, we might come across an Ardipithecus. And when you observe it from a distance, from several hundred meters away, through the vegetation, you would have been struck that it's not walking on its knuckles. It's not a knuckle walk. It's not a chimpanzee. And yet, as it gets closer, it's not a human either. It's a very small head atop this body, but the body is erect. It's walking on 2 feet. And then we'd probably see it move quickly away from us and find that it's able to move around in the trees in a way that we're not, because its foot can still grasp. It has very, very long arms, very long fingers, very effective at moving through this arboreal habitat. Now, if we were lucky enough to be able to watch it eat, we'd be able to see what kind of foods it was after. And it was an omnivore. It would have been gathering small game and perhaps invertebrates along the woodland floor. And it also would have been able to go effectively up into the trees to gather ripe fruit, figs. And we know these things because, for instance, we found the pollen that indicates the fig trees are there. We found the seeds from the hackberry trees. We have found the bird fossils showing us that peacocks were present in this place 4.4 million years ago. So we're able to put this ecological snapshot together from hard evidence. And so in a sense, the fossils and the sediments they're in become our time machine, and they allow us to look back and to see this. So what we have done is to reassemble the most complete Ardipithecus that we've managed to find. This partial skeleton with hands and feet and a head and arms and legs and a pelvis. And the natural history artist, Jay Maternus, has sketched out what the skeleton looked like. It's a female individual, would have been about 4 feet tall, and would have had, of course, muscles and ultimately hair and everything. Those are gone now. We only have the bones. And so Jay, through his great knowledge of comparative primate anatomy and going over these bones one by one and how they fit together and how they might have moved, he's recreated what Ardipithecus would have looked like had we been able to go back into that environment at 4.4 million years ago. And so we are dealing with a creature that is no longer here. You can't find them anywhere in Africa except through the fossil record.
The research talks, the papers in Science talk to some degree about the lack of long, sharp canines in Ardipithecus. What does that tell you about their social behavior?
When you look at other primates, whether you look at baboons or gorillas or chimpanzees, the males of the species have very big, very sharp, very projecting canine teeth. And they mostly use these teeth for conflicts among themselves. And the conflicts are often over access to female individuals ready for mating, estrus females in the populations. And again, this is based on living primates. The real exception to that rule in living primates is modern people. You look at modern people, we don't have big sharp canines, and we don't go around threatening one another with big sharp canines. Well, of course, Darwin and many other scholars of his day saw this and wanted to come up with an explanation for, you know, why is it that humans have lost these weapons? And for many years, it's been thought that stone tools were invented at some point, and the canine would have been reduced as handheld weapons supplanted its function. And this was the general explanation. But what we found, starting in the 1970s, with the discovery of the Lucy species in Ethiopia and in Tanzania, early hominids had small canines from even 3.5 to 4 million years ago. Even the males, small non-projecting canines, and they were fully bipedal. And so we were interested, of course, in finding older fossils to see whether they would be more chimpanzee-like. And now we've found Ardipithecus. We have a good many individuals. We know that their canine teeth are not only smaller than chimpanzees, but they're also shaped very differently. They have a diamond shape. They're blunt. Even the largest male, Ardipithecus, would not have had a canine that functioned in that way. So what does this mean? And what does it have to do with bipedality? So my colleague Owen Lovejoy at Kent State University has come up in one of the papers of this package published in Science with the expansion and elaboration of ideas that he started to have when Lucy was found. And now we see in Ardipithecus a very early biped with a lack of these big projecting male canines. In fact, we track this. We have even older remains of Ardipithecus in our area, and remains from Chad, and remains from Kenya. And none of these, all the way back to 6 million years ago, have big projecting male canines. And they all seem to be early bipeds. And so Lovejoy thinks that this goes together, that the reduction of the male canine is telling us something very important about social organization, that the male individual has been brought into the parenting process, and that the carrying of food is deeply involved in this, and really set apart our family, our branch of the family tree, from what we see in all these other primates. And so he links walking on two legs with the reduction of the canine tooth. And so that's the hypothesis. Now, as we go back beyond Ardipithecus into that zone of perhaps 7 million years ago of the last common ancestor, we'll be very interested to see what the last common ancestor had in the way of canine dimorphism. It looks like in chimpanzees, at least common chimpanzee, that canine dimorphism has become highly evolved. And we know these today to be the most aggressive primates when it comes to male-male competition over estrus female. So what we see is very early in the hominid line, this is not going on. Natural selection has led to the reduction of this male canine tooth very, very early in time, right at the base of our branch of the family tree.
So does that tell us then that there's less conflict of the type you might see among chimpanzees and more tendency to cooperation?
Yes, and Lovejoy's model is involving the cooperation between the male individuals who are no longer fighting over estrus females, but rather putting time and energy into the provisioning of dependent young. And so Lovejoy's model links social structure in the form of monogamy in these early hominids that we don't see in chimps and gorillas or anything else. What he sees is a pair bonding between males and females very early in time. And that's basically the only way to capture the male energy, which in all these other primates goes into the weaponry, display, aggression, and mating based on that. And so Lovejoy points to things that are not commonly thought of in paleontology, things like the fact that at the end of the human lineage, which is where we are today, ovulation is actually fairly concealed, even from modern married people. And so that, we don't think of that as making us very different from most other primates, but it really does. We don't have an estrus like all these other primates have. The permanently enlarged female breast could be another emblematic biological signal of something that has very deep evolutionary roots, that the male no longer is able to say, to tell, to discern whether the female is ovulating or breastfeeding. So he places, Lovejoy, my colleague at Kent State, places a lot of attention on aspects that are often unavailable to us through the fossil record. That is the soft tissue evidence from modern people. He cites physiological evidence in the biology of modern primates, both chimps and humans. He cites the fossil evidence, the ecological evidence. And so what his paper does is to integrate all of this information and come up with a hypothesis about how it was that our lineage diverged from lineages leading on to chimpanzees and became, through evolution, the very different primate that we are today.